A few minutes after 3 here on The Classical Now. You're tuned to KCSB FM, Santa Barbara. Well, I have a very special second half of my program today. And I have here in the studio with me my good friend, John Mead, who is here to offer a tantalizing tidbit for the upcoming talk and presentation at the Institute of World Culture this Saturday. That'll be May the 7th, excuse me. And you can find out information about the genius of Renaissance music and its place in world culture if you go to worldculture.org. John Mead taught college-level music for 20 years at art academies in Italy, in Greece, and in Chicago, where, as he says, born to be a compulsive explainer, he developed skills in demystifying the intricacies of music to non-musicians. So don't be intimidated by the phrase genius of Renaissance music. John's love of 16th century music started back with ecstatic experiences as a chorister of age 14. His formal education included classic studies at a preparatory level, and then he studied with Leo Sowerby, the Pulitzer Prize winning composer. John's mentor and teacher for his conducting was William Ferris. I think we'll hear some of Mr. Ferris's music today. Ferris was twice nominated for the Pulitzer. John has held positions as organist and choir master while concurrently teaching high school mathematics. Later, as if that isn't enough, he went into IT. At a very seminal moment for IT, I might add. To add to what he describes as a series of life coincidences, he also had an association with Buckminster Fuller in Greece, which had a profound influence on John's life, including spiritual matters and a completion of the Master of Science. And it is my very great pleasure to say hello to John. Hi, John. Thanks for being with us today.
Joe, thanks. Great to be here.
You know, I wanted to start off with this, what to me is a fascinating connection, that you had some personal association, I'm assuming, with Buckminster Fuller.
Yes, well, it started to be accidental, and then it turned out to be life-changing. In fact, that's how I got into IT. What happened is I was teaching at this school in Greece. I was teaching, of course, in music history, and Fuller was in Athens. I had some work he was doing there. He was there in the summers, and we were on an island, and once you got out to the island, it was a good place to stay. I mean, you didn't travel back and forth very easily to the mainland because of the ferry boats. You had to go by the ferry boat schedule. So I forgot how it happened. I assumed that his boat had to arrive way before his talk, and so he came to hear my lecture. And actually, he wrote a poem for me, which I promptly lost, not having sufficient appreciation for just who Fuller was. Building domes and that just didn't quite interest me that much. But I'll tell you what, in order to get this school to pay me enough, they said to me, how would you like to be the staff photographer? And I said, okay. So I got a 400-millimeter lens, and I had to cover Buckminster Fuller. And so inadvertently, I heard all of his lectures. And it didn't. And we had dinner sometimes, got to know each other a bit. Although I have to say that he could never say anything that didn't last for 4 hours.
That's right.
There's
a great irony about that. Yeah. Because, and you probably know this, but he had a major life transformation. He was trying to follow in the footsteps of his father and go into business and do all the things that were demanded of him from the outside. And it led him to, once he had a family, it led him to a severe crisis of depression. And he was on the verge of drowning himself.
Yes,
speaking
like
of
Michigan,
waterways and ferries, he was on the edge of drowning himself. And the And what stopped him from killing himself was the insight about being true to oneself and about what would be the life worth living. It would be worth living for others. And so he didn't kill himself. He didn't even go in the water. But what he did is he came out, he realized, well, I don't know anything. I have nothing to say. And he remained silent. He refused to speak for 3 years. And when he began to speak, as you say, as you rightly said, he couldn't stop. And he coined like a whole new language. I mean, synergetics, the fascinating technical language, and had a whole cosmology, a whole way of viewing the world, a whole way of refiguring geometry. There were fascinating inventions, of course, including the geodesic dome.
Do you know his analogy with calling himself Trim Tab? It was called ephemeralization. The idea was getting the maximum effect with the minimum effort.
Ah, right.
And it's the trim tab in the rudder that really turns the ship.
Right. So that was a guiding analogy.
Call me Trim Tab.
Yeah.
And that's what he wanted to see to do with his life. What kind of effect a small person could have.
Yeah.
You know? Of course, he was a genius.
He was. He was a very inspiring figure. Of course, I don't know if you've... Did you ever try to bend your mind onto that tome called Synergetics? Wasn't that the
yes.
major work?
Yeah, the two volumes. Yeah, I wouldn't say I got very far with it.
You know, and it's like mathematically written. Every statement is numbered with, you know, subnumbers and subnumbers, and it's all put together in this seemingly incredible logical way. But he uses so much of his own language. You have to be steeped in Fuller to begin to make sense of that.
Yeah, well, I stopped at that, but I read most of his other texts, No More Secondhand Gods. But anyway,
I want to get into the Renaissance music, but my closing comment about him was there was a little book called Bucky and the Kids that was edited together. I mean, I think he had a hand in it, but it was mostly the people around him, and it was chronicling some sessions he had with children. And in that, there were little. He demonstrated how to build some really fascinating little models that I became fascinated with, and I built. You could build a stick and latex tube thing of the cube octahedron, which is a solid combining the sides of the cube and the octahedron, and the squares mutate, but the triangles remain stable. And so it does this wonderful dance, which he called the jitterbug. And he felt it was some cosmic model of something. I don't understand the cosmology of it, but it's a fascinating thing to build for geometry. So I always did that with my daughter. And then the other thing is he showed how to build very clever paper models of the cube octahedron, too. We used to decorate the Christmas trees with them. So Bucky Fuller
was always, right.
Yeah, you know, it resonates with
Well, them. He told me that the universe provides three things. It provides material, energy, and information. And information was the only one of the three that was infinitely duplicatable.
Right.
Without regard to location. And so that's how I got into IT.
Wow.
Because information was going to be. So I got into the information processing aspect.
That's fascinating. Yeah, information was a model of ontological plenty for him. Yeah. I don't know if he ever said anything about music, did he? That you knew. I think he was a musician.
No, he wasn't.
Yeah.
I can't recall anything, though.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't have. Mostly, I was listening to him most of the time.
And of course.
And then when I was looking for another occupation, I read just about everything. This was in New York at the New School for Social Research. I read all his books, and I said, that's it, computers. And it's just the means. I wasn't interested in computers per se, but just as a means.
Yeah.
And here we are.
That's amazing. That's great, John.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad the Institute of World Culture is tapping you. This Saturday, to remind listeners, this Saturday, May the 7th, it is a free presentation. Seating is limited, but I think they seat about 50 or so. However, 12 of those seats are going to be taken up by Adelphos Ensemble Singers, led by Temo Coroscelli. Presentation, The Genius of Renaissance Music and Its Place in World Culture. You have had a long fascination with the beginnings of polyphony in Western music.
Yes. In fact, calling it Renaissance music is very strange because the Renaissance really applies very perfectly to architecture, you know, beginning of the Renaissance in Florence. And music serves a certain function there. But in no way was it looking back because there was no notation to look back to. There was no classical I mean, finally, when they did one thing, it was the end of the Renaissance, was the invention of opera as an attempt to reconstruct Greek drama, which was always sung.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, there's no notation for it.
Right.
And so it's only recited today.
That's interesting. So when we speak about Renaissance or rebirth, we're talking about the restarting of a culture, a resurgence in a culture where the current forms are stale and they fall away. We're really primarily speaking about, well, of course, the rediscovery of Plato's dialogues,
right,
which was really important.
And how to build a dome.
How to build a church. Okay, so the architecture things.
That's right. In fact, that really is the most defining moment when Brunelleschi goes to see the cathedral at, as you know, there's a joke about this, the cathedral in Florence was built without a dome, but they built a huge circumference opening for the dome, and the joke is, well, when they started building it, they said, well, we're just in the Middle Ages now, we don't know how to do that, but by the time this building gets built, it'll be the Renaissance. Let them figure it out, you know.
But that's true. The walls were ahead of the. I mean, the dome. Obviously,
yeah.
The dome has.
And so Brunelleschi went to the previous building with a large dome had been the Pantheon. So he went to Rome to get ideas for the Pantheon. Well, that was built with concrete. I don't think concrete was available. They didn't get the mix right. But he did it with bricks. And it's even today, it's the largest standing brick dome in the world.
Hmm. And you have to have a really thought out method for doing that.
And we'll show a diagram of how he did that, of the key to distributing the weight, because he wasn't allowed to use any buttresses on the walls.
Hmm.
That was against the that was the Gothic idea.
Yeah.
Florence wanted nothing to do with that. So well, in any case, this is a segue into the music, because this solving this problem, putting up this beautiful dome, was such an event that the rededication of the cathedral was done by the Pope, who came to Florence, and a special piece was written by Dufay for the event. But what's interesting here is that the architect, painters, etc., were Italians, but all of the names in music in Italy were French or Flemings.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he's a Burgundian school, but I think it gets called the Netherlands school in the next generation, but I think that's because they disappeared on the map. They got eaten up. Mm. You know, the borders kept changing.
Dufay was about 120 years or something before Palestrina.
Yes, okay, right.
He was a Franco-Flemish composer.
The reason we bring him up is because he really was there at the beginning of the Renaissance in Florence.
Oh.
And so I can't find the exact place. There's such a fine gradation about the way the Renaissance in music takes off. It's not like Impressionism, where there's some very clear-cut philosophic basis, you see. But rather the music supported, I mean, the way it worked is there was religion, then there was the institutional church, then there was the ritual that had to happen every day of the year.
Right.
There had to be music for every day of the year.
Uh-huh.
So when you think about it, the number of musicians who were employed, we're talking, you know, 30 to 40 Renaissance cities.
Oh. Right, so it's massive.
It was massive, and it has to be done every single day.
Oh.
So the amount of the call for the music, in Gregorian chant, just to know the chants for the year, it required someone to... The singer had to know about 85 to 90 hours of music. So it took about 10 years as a novice just to learn the music, and that has to do with the evolution of music manuscripts of, you know, a form of notation, and then eventually music printing, which hit in 1501. And so the music of Dufay's generation, that we know the names of people, but we don't have a lot of the music.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the next generation, and incidentally, the Italians took over right before Palestrina. His two teachers were both French.
Hmm.
But by Palestrina's time, all the names are Italian.
Oh.
But I thought it's interesting that the Renaissance in all the arts, including literature, they're all Italian, but not in music.
Yeah.
Franco-Flemish.
And then, Franco-Flemish.
But by the 16th century, the Italians really, really take over. And we have some good examples of the Flemings. The last one we're doing is the Arquedelt, a madrigal.
Mm-hmm. That will be playing at the...
That's right.
Thing. Right. I think we've got something by Dufay queued up here.
Okay.
Do you want to tell us something about it?
Well, yeah, it was short. The very famous piece that he wrote, I didn't want to put on the program because it would just take too much time. Okay, I would say this about this piece. Interestingly, some people still think of it as the Middle Ages, and I think the reason is because there's something off in the cadence. The cadence is archaic. And once the next generation gets onto the cadences that eventually were used from then on up till today, see, my view is that this was an engineering project.
And, in what way?
Well, that it's not as much of an invention as much as a discovery, that they were discovering what works with harmony. And once they discovered it, they never looked back.
Mm-hmm.
Never looked back. And you can see this evolution.
Like in the analogies, like in mechanical engineering, we discover a certain way
That's right.
to work with the laws of nature. And once we discover that...
It's forever.
Yeah.
And that's what this was. And the example that I use is that how easily people give up very subtle and beautiful music in third world countries because they hear three chords. They give it up very quickly. The reason is that the music may have a lot of melodic subtlety, quarter tones, etc., which doesn't, it sounds out of tune in a chordal system. And so the first thing that the chordal system does is to impose a scale of eight notes. And people give this up very quickly. And also, the West is the only place where this has ever been invented. But anybody who hears it, whatever culture it is in the world, they go, yeah, that's it. That's it.
It has some particular powerful psychological allure.
Right. And I think I really think it's an engineering having to do with dissonance, a trade-off between dissonance and consonance, having to do with the addition of the third and the sixth, which I go into. You see, in the early combination of notes, only the fourth, fifth, and octave were considered consonant.
Right.
And that is why in the Middle Ages, there's a great literature of monophonic music. People say, oh, I love the Middle Age music. You know, they're thinking of the Cantigas, the Santa Maria, a lot of wonderful literature at that time, but it's not harmonized.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the things that are harmonized are very strange sounding. And to me, it's because they didn't decide on the third and the sixth. They threw those out as being dissonances, and you can't write, you can't go anywhere with it. So you can't even harmonize a melody with it, with the chant. And I find this interesting because when the Catholic Church decided to make some formalities in the late 18th, 19th centuries about music, they... lost my train of thought.
That's right. About the third and the sixth.
Yeah, right. They skipped over everything between Gregorian chant and polyphony. They just skipped it right over like it didn't exist. And as a result, what happens, as long as you had the mass form, the ritual form from the Council of Trent that was active until the late 60s, then the texts have to be sung at all masses. They have to be sung. And then you have a choice of two things. You can either take the original Gregorian chant or you can take a setting by a Renaissance or Baroque composer or contemporary, not so much though at that time.
Let's go ahead and hear this. This is the Purcell Consort of Voices singing a piece by how do you pronounce his first name? Is it Guillaume?
Yeah, Guillaume.
Guillaume.
Guillaume. I think that's
Dufay.
Dufay.
And this is called Latin, what?
Francur. It's medieval French. Francur Gentil.
Very good.
Thank you.
a little tidbit there by the Purcell consort of voices, music by Dufay. And my guest today, it's my great pleasure to have John Mead with me today. John will be presenting next week at the Institute of World Culture, Saturday, May 7th at 2 o'clock. You can find more information about that at worldculture.org, a presentation entitled The Genius of Renaissance Music and Its Place in World Culture. And John, so while that Dufay was playing, it did sound a little strange. Why did it sound strange?
Well, I'm not taking the position like a musicologist would. Kind of all things are valid, and what I'm saying is that there was an engineering project going on, and they didn't quite have the cement mixture right. They were using what was called a double leading tone, a leading tone both into the tonic, like B to C, and at the same time a leading tone from the F sharp into G.
Mm-hmm.
The whole idea was that only the fifth and the octave were recognized as consonant.
Right. And so, now, do you think psychologically, when we talk about how over the centuries, what we consider consonant, what we consider at one time was considered dissonant. Is it relative to culture? Do we literally? Right.
That's the exact point I'm making, is that it seems that we do have, it's been discovered that tens of thousands of years, the human brain had the capacity to do long division, but didn't have the software to do it. There was no reason to be doing long division in your cave, but it had to be there. It's a precondition to being able to, and I think the same thing is true here.
Hmm.
And that's why people so quickly give up what they were thinking was music until they hear this.
And so relatively speaking, in music history, we find this changing very fast. And is Palestrina then the major innovator?
No.
Okay.
The innovation came before him, and he was handed a platter full of techniques. Hmm. And what's so great about Palestrina is you don't get tired of them at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Composers of earlier generations, they had it worked out. They were the engineers, but not the artists. That's what makes him a genius.
Mm-hmm.
The mixture of the cement had been given to him, and he took off with it.
And he knew he was in a position to pull together everything.
Absolutely.
Well, is it comparable to Bach then?
Yes.
That
oh,
Bach
absolutely.
Came at a time
right.
to pull things.
That's
he
right.
becomes a nexus for
That's
using
right.
or Shakespeare.
Right.
You know. You
yes.
Could,
mm-hmm. Well, it's very very true. In fact, the only thing missing in Renaissance polyphony, well, besides some more chords. Well, I mean, the reason it took off is because there had to be so much music produced all the time for these daily services. And so people could experiment, if you want to use that word.
Mm-hmm.
And Dufay, to me, almost has it right, but just not quite. Last little detail to be added. Now, what I'm going to do is give people some take home. Like, there's a composition written that Dufay wrote for the when the dome was put on the cathedral and Pope Eugene IV came to rededicate the church on the 25th of March, 1436. Mm-hmm. How's that precise? And this particular piece of music says, recent garlands of roses given by the Pope, despite a terrible winter, adorned this temple of magnificent structure.
They must add greenhouses, I imagine.
So this work they can hear on YouTube. And we'll tell them where to get it, because I don't want to take the time to listen to it, because I want to get into what would be called the High Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
This, to me, is still transition.
Now, speaking of transition, what about the figure of Jacob van Berchem? He was another Franco-Flemish composer, but he comes somewhat 25 years or so before Palestrina was born.
Yes,
I think.
Again, he's given the same the materials that he had are essentially the materials that Palestrina had. In other words, if you were to take a measure from the music of Josquin or the composer here you're talking about, and Josquin look at a measure of Palestrina, there wouldn't be any difference. It's the larger view of the way they're put together. It's much more subtle. So the first thing that you hear is the engineering. The first thing that you hear is this style. And this became so important that it's hard to believe that people like Mozart and Beethoven had to study it. And we now know that Bach knew Palestrina's Missa Brevis. And then there was the quotation of Wagner. I wouldn't have thought that Wagner heard Palestrina, but he did. And he said he creates a world that's timeless and spaceless.
Boy, that's so true. As a former chorister, both have sung Palestrina. It's an amazing experience to sing that music. His imagination as a composer never failed to fascinate me, because one of the things that I noticed as a singer was, you know, we are conditioned musically, a kid my age growing up in this culture, and into to think in terms of discrete bars, and you feel the musical cadence go through, you know, 8 bars or 16 bars of right. The way a lot of music is written, certainly pop music or show music, but various classical
Mozart
music.
But
it's not true about Palestrina.
That's right. It's through composed. You see, it's driven by the text. But when you take away the text, and that's how instrumental music was, very little music written for instruments per se at this time, other than dance music. And so they oftentimes played polyphonic music. But there gets to be a problem with that, is that there's no connection between the earlier, in other words, each phrase of the original plain song chant gets transformed into a polyphonic section. But the polyphonic sections only hang together because of the text. But if you do it well with instruments, there's nothing that ever repeats itself, you see. Oh. It's just through composed.
Right.
And so that's why the fugue in the Baroque period works that out. And that's another session.
Right. Or it reminds you of Bach's preludes, right, which had no repeats and were just straight through pieces as well. And it's also true, right, what's used in instrumental orchestration today, it was learned for voices. The first orchestras in Western music were voicestras.
Well, see, and I would argue that until you had something, you don't want to develop fine violins until you have something worth playing. And they had to work out the consonants and the dissonance first. And then suddenly there's a motivation.
All right.
But doing the violin in the Middle Ages wouldn't have made a great deal of sense.
I've got queued up here Berkham's piece.
Oh, Jesu Christi.
Yeah. Why don't we listen to that?
Sure. Just make a comment about it.
Yes.
Is that we're going to talk a lot about the difference between polyphonic texture and harmonic texture, and the difference being where the emphasis is. In other words, you can't write harmony. If I have a part for one instrument or one voice, and then I write a harmony below it, the harmonic notes all have to get connected, and so I've created a second melody inadvertently. Now, if my emphasis is on creating the melody where the harmony is secondary, we would call it polyphonic writing, and if it's more on the harmony and the melody is less important, we call it polyphonic writing. I'm sorry.
Harmonic
writing. So what's interesting about this piece is that the first...
So wait, let me just get this straight. So in polyphonic writing, every voice has a kind of integrity to it?
That's correct.
Whereas in harmonic writing, you get a distinction between foreground and background.
And one of the things that they had discovered in the 15th century was how important the top voice was for having the melody. And so what we'll hear in the Van Berkham is the first and the last phrase are very homophonic. But the middle two phrases are very polyphonic, with voices coming, and they're using the technique of imitation, just like Row Your Boat or a song that we sing. But that's a perfect round here, and the reason I brought this particular piece up is because I looked on YouTube and I said, well, I wonder who's got a recording of this, and I found at least 20 of them from all over the world, several from Asia, including one which had no comment in English at all. It was all Chinese characters, and except I think the The director's name was Joseph Yu, I think. I got that right. And I'll give people a handout on it. I said, why is this particular piece here? We're not even, I mean, he's not, this is not even Palestrina. You know, how is it that there can be so many? And then I realized from a performance point of view, it's kind of an entry level because the polyphonic sections, which are the second section and the third, are very simple melodies. Very easy to harmonize, very easy to imitate. And the second polyphonic piece begins domine, domine, and it comes in just at the octave and the fifth. The voices shout, Lord, Lord, at octaves and fifths. And then all of a sudden, the third is added. And you go, oh, it's awesome. A minor third comes in there. And then the fourth section is the repetition of Have Mercy on Me, Miserere Mei. And one could speak about there being relative harmony and polyphony, and that's what Palestrina does so well, is to get that balance perfect. But this actually is a very good piece, and like I say, it's entry level if you have a high school choir or a parish choir.
Okay, and so, again, this is very short. So this Van Berkom piece is just about 3 minutes. O Jesu Christe. That was the Catholic Academy University Choir, Lublin, Poland, with music by Van Berkom, My guest today is John Mead. By the way, you're tuned to KCSB FM Santa Barbara. This is The Classical Now with Joseph Miller. This program is broadcast every Sunday afternoon from 2 to 4 o'clock. John Mead will be speaking next week at the Institute of World Culture at 1407 Chapala Street from 2 to 5 p.m. on the genius of Renaissance music and its place in world culture. It is a free event, and you can find out more about it at worldculture.org. And so it was fascinating. I wish all of you could have been in the booth while that was playing, because John was spelling out exactly what was happening as the piece was unfolding, and when very emotional intervals suddenly entered in, and where very primitive intervals were being used at first, octaves and fifths, and then the utterly revolutionary minor third coming in.
Yeah. And I was singing this particular piece when I was 14, and I remember how awesome it was. Of course, we had a great setting in this cathedral, you know, and there were two choirs. Can you imagine? The polyphonic choir was 120, and the choir that sang chant was 60 people. And right after we'd sing a piece of Palestrina, then there'd be a plain song choir singing the intro. I mean, it was really awesome. And then after that, the organ would come in and there'd be some big piece. And I thought, oh, gosh, why don't we just go home now and call it a day?
Right. That's like putting too much frosting on the cake or something. Was this in Chicago?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Right.
And so you were a boy chorister.
What happened is that, I went to the local seminary, which was just two blocks from the cathedral. And I didn't understand all this at 14, you know. It's a 40-minute ride from your house to get to this location. And, you know, they try your voice, don't tell you what's going on. Okay, you'll be here at such and such a date. And then it came time to sing in the cathedral, and there it was. And, you know, I mean, a lot of this has been removed now. I mean, it was the Renaissance church, you know, big throne for the cardinal. And you addressed the cardinal as your eminence, and the bishop was your excellency.
Mm-hmm.
And the director of the choir was Monsignor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a different time. I feel like I was born in another century.
But getting in there, now, of course, let's go back to some basics for our listeners.
Yes.
For this kind of music, the venue is absolutely essential. It's part of the instrument. The reverb in these cathedrals, absolutely essential. And this had a huge emotional effect on you, a spiritual effect. At that age. I mean, you literally had some kind of ecstatic experience.
Well, as the Dalai Lama once said about the Christian church, he said, boy, they really can put on a show.
But there was something more than the showmanship here.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, you've used the Indian word samadhi to describe the kind of state that you gone into. And so you felt something calling you. Yeah. At a very early age about this.
In fact, that's why I was compelled. You notice I didn't think 2 seconds about it, because my life has been any time that something happened in polyphonic music of the Renaissance, that was a calling to me.
Hmm.
This has to be done. Hmm. This has to be done.
Wow. That's like in the tales, your magical creature showing up on right in the you say, follow that rabbit.
Right. You know,
he's the guidance. Yeah. Oh, fascinating. You gave me two very peculiar sounding recordings that sound almost like they were digitized on the wrong speed. Why don't you talk to me about this?
Okay, well, when I was 14, for the first time I heard Palestrina, and the first thing that I thought was, well, I got all these baseball cards and that, but who is this guy? Who is Palestrina?
Who does he throw for?
And I wanted to talk to someone about it, you know. Yeah. And even the director of the choir was, oh, well, you're just a boy. Run along now and have fun. Mm-hmm. No one would take me seriously. Oh. And I went to the record store at that time and bought a recording of Palestrina, and it was a recording of the Sistine Chapel Choir. And then the following year, I would meet a member of the choir who'd moved to Chicago. And we've been friends ever since then. Hmm. He's always correcting my Italian, Maurizio. And no, I mean, it's way beyond that.
Yeah.
But in any case, there became a devotion to Palestrina as a result of this recording.
Hmm.
And it is slow. It is a slow interpretation, and the intonation isn't good by modern standards, etc. But what I like that he does is the emphasis of the Latin words, puere ebriorum. He gets the accent so right, and it affects. Now, it's a little bit of a, I don't know if you'd say an operatic effect, but you see, the director of music in the cathedral in Chicago was a classmate of the director of the Pope's choir. They went to school at the Pontifical Institute at the same years. And so he brought back this sound. And when, so when I heard this choir, I said, how did they get that sound so close to ours? Well, we were imitating. And I remember one time Monsignor was interviewed by someone who was very enamored with the English style of perfection in vocal tone. And Meter said, oh, no, he said, we believe in the Italian method of the boy's natural ringing voice. You know. And so this recording reflects that. And
this is a 1955.
It was like 55.
Was it a long play or a 78?
No, it's a long play.
It was a long play.
Yeah, it was the first LP, probably. And, of course, it was done in a studio at that time. You wouldn't record in the Sistine Chapel.
Oh, yes.
But this is the Sistine Chapel choir under Bartolucci, Domenico Bartolucci, who just died about a year and a half ago.
Oh. Amazing. Okay.
And this particular piece is so haunting because, you see, when the imitation comes in, when the second voice comes in and it's real close, it creates a tension. It's an attention issue, but what are you going to pay attention to? You just got interested in the first voice, and now the second one is singing this, and there's a third one. Mm-hmm. And so there's this, and yet he does it with this most relaxed way, and it's the most minimal thing I've ever found Palestrina ever write for a melody. It's basically the drop of a third. Pu-ri, and a voice comes right in, pu-ri, and it's just very, this is the theme for Palm Sunday. The children of the Hebrews were carrying palms of olive branches, and they shouted out, Hosanna in the highest. And, of course, that is a whole new polyphonic section then with the Hosanna. I think it's a very stirring piece.
Does the Hosanna come in on this particular?
Yes, it does.
Okay, let's hear that. A 1955 recording. This is the Sistine Chapel Choir, but recorded in a studio and from the record collection of John Mead. And an early vinyl that captured his heart. Okay, that was this wonderful a recording with character, the Sistine Chapel Choir, singing Puere Habere Orum, and a work for Palm Sunday. That was recorded, at least it was published in 1955 by the Sistine Chapel Choir, and digitized by John Mead or somebody he knew. You know, one thing that occurs to me, John, is, was this music that the common person was exposed to, or was it only the social and economic elite who went into the cathedrals where this great music was being sung?
No, the cathedrals were large enough for people of the town to go. It was a great event. And what people made of it, I don't know, but I would say that the attention spans were better than they are today. You know, there wasn't so much distraction, and I don't know what they knew about it. I mean, at this time there was no middle class. There was no such thing as a public concert. Mm-hmm. You either heard mass because you were in the court, and that would have been exclusive. Mm. Common people would not go into the courts, mm-hmm. but they would go into the cathedral.
Right.
In fact, you know, St. Peter's in Rome was being built during Palestrina's lifetime. It started a generation before him, and tremendous activity under Julius II. And it was finally finished totally with decoration and everything a generation after Palestrina. So his whole life, as he was going to the Sistine Chapel, the building was going up, and he eventually became the choir director. You know, the choir at St. Peter's is different from the Sistine Chapel choir. Mm-hmm. Because they go with the church, but the Sistine Chapel Choir goes wherever the Pope is. Mm-hmm. So when he's in St. Peter's, the choir for St. Peter's stays home. Mm-hmm. In any case, so Palestrina was appointed. I've wondered for a long time, what stages, at what point could they actually use St. Peter's? Mm-hmm. Because, are you ready for this? You know what the seating capacity is? Asking about whether it's for the common man or not. The number of people that are held in St. Peter's is 60,000.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is massive.
Yeah. And even that isn't large enough, which is why they have services on the front steps.
Right.
For Easter. Yeah, just saying.
And would there have been music? Obviously, there was mass every day. Was there music every day?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah,
that's correct. Polyphonic masses were sung every day. Maybe there'd only be four singers, a quartet, but mm-hmm. there were singers hired who were, that was their occupation. Mm-hmm.
Well,
you know?
Yeah. Well, let's see what Victoria fit into all this? Thomas Victoria was. Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes he's called the Spanish Palestrina.
Right, right. Well, his education and his formative years were all in Rome, and he's considered a Roman of the Roman school. He didn't go back to Spain until much later in his life. Oh. And he would just be the right age to have been a student of Palestrina. Mm-hmm. That seems pretty obvious to me.
And what about Orlan de Lassus?
Okay. Yes, he's like the final generation of the Netherlands composers. He was born in what today would be Mon, Belgium.
Okay.
But he lived most of his life in Italy, also in France, and for a while in Germany. Mm. And he's the only one of those three composers who wrote. Well, Palestrina did write some madrigals in Italian. Victoria never wrote anything except in Latin for the church. Mm-hmm. He was a priest, if that makes any difference, and a Spaniard to
boot.
Right. But De Lasso wrote a lot of secular music in French, German, and Italian, ridiculing and, I mean, lighthearted kind of stuff. I mean, there's one that he wrote which I thought was some early form of Italian, but actually what it is, it's a ridiculing. In other words, the misspelled Italian words are actually the way a German who was trying to court an Italian woman would speak.
Hmm.
Instead of Madonna, it's Matona.
Huh.
Anyway.
Yeah. So a certain vulgarity or informality
oh, yes. Yeah.
involved.
Yeah.
we've got, let's see. Oh, you know, I want to ask you, we could queue up something. We got to watch the time a little bit.
Yeah.
I do want to remind listeners, you're tuned to KCSB FM Santa Barbara. This is The Classical Now. Joseph Miller, my guest today, is John Mead, who will be giving a presentation, a free presentation next Saturday, May the 7th, on the genius of Renaissance music and its place in world culture. The presentation will also feature the voices of Santa Barbara's own Adelphos under the direction of Temo Coroscelli. At 4 o'clock today, your premier jazz program for the weekend, Roots to the Source with Marta Olveas. You know, I wanted to ask you about your association with William Ferris.
Mm-hmm.
And did you sing in the William Ferris Chorale?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Well, Bill was actually the organist at the cathedral. When I was 14, he was 19, and he was the organist. And he's a genius. Bill is an absolute genius, and he was very kind to me, I must say. He died prematurely.
Of a heart attack when he was 63 years old.
That's right.
And he was conducting at the time.
He was conducting a rehearsal of the Verdi Requiem.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is one of his earlier pieces, if we're going to play that. I don't know if that's in the cards for it. It's very interesting. I mean, you'll recognize it's polyphonic, but, well, long discussion about the dissonances. And the second part of the text goes into Divisi parts, where it says, taste and see, the Lord is sweet. The first part is just, whoever eats my body and drinks my bread shall have life in him. But the second part is in the Old Testament. And quoniam suavis est, how sweet it is. And he just has these sweet ninth, 13th chords, and it's all just very, just very lush.
Very good. Why don't we listen to that?
Yeah.
This is from Lyrica Sacra, the William Ferris Chorale, composition by William Ferris. Music by William Ferris from the William Ferris Chorale there playing. I want to thank John Mead for coming in today and spellbinding our discussion here and really just a taste for what's to come next Saturday. That's May the 7th, 2 to 4 o'clock, the Institute of World Culture. Look it up, the Genius of Renaissance Music. That's go to worldculture.org. Thanks, John, so much for being with me.
Oh, Joe, it's a real pleasure to reflect on all these things after so many years. Thank you.
Oh, it's just amazing. Up next is Martel Veyes with Roots to the Source. I want to give a shout-out to Jonah for giving a call. Thanks so much, Jonah. Look me up on Facebook. You can find more about The Classical Now at The Classical Now on Facebook. See you next week. Have a great week. Happy May Day to you. So long.